I am Planta on the line. This is the commentary.ca. 6 months in Sudan, a young doctor in a war-torn village is a new memoir from Dr. James Maskelic. He writes about his time in Sudan amidst war, working for Médecins Sans Frontières. In 2007, Dr. Maskelic takes leave of Toronto's St. Michael's Hospital, where he's an ER doctor, to understand Sudan and treat their malnourished children. 6 months later, he invariably feels affected by the experience, and you read that in this book. You also read about the people that he meets along the way, and you're affected by them. The book is published by Doubleday. Dr. Maskelic began writing a blog on the Doctors Without Borders website. He is an assistant professor at the University of Toronto Faculty of Medicine, and he continues to practice emergency medicine at St. Michael's. He is co-founder of the open access medical journal Open Medicine. He joins me from Toronto this day. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, James Maskelic. Good morning, Dr. Maskelic.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. How did you hook up with Médecins Sans Frontières, and was that was in 2007, right?
Yeah, that was in 2007. It was my first mission, but I'd worked with MSF before as a journalist. I went in 2005 and wrote about neglected diseases in both South America and Southern Africa.
The reading your bio, you seem to have gone to places like Chile, Cambodia, Bolivia. Well, what draws you to go to those places? Or what drew you to go to those places, I should say?
I think there's two aspects. You know, one is as a person and one is as a physician. And as a person, I think I'm just curious by nature and have always been interested in going to places that, you know, maybe other people haven't been or that are difficult to get to. You know, whether looking for you know, the path less traveled by or something. And so I think that's part of it. And then the second part of it is as a physician, and, you know, as you probably recognize that those places aren't really something that you would choose to go to for a vacation. They're actually very difficult, and that's why medical health isn't so easily accessible there. But as a physician, it seems to be like those places that are most in need of having some attention given to them, where the people who live there have very difficult time accessing even simple medical treatments and care.
And does that, as a physician, that must confound you? That, I mean, you work at St. Michael's in Toronto, and, you know, any procedure, any sort of medicine that you possibly could need, you have. And then you go to a place like in Sudan, where you were in Abaya, and, you know, simple medicines for measles, for example, are unavailable.
Yeah, it's true. I'm able to say with, you know, real sincerity that, you know, to my patients who I work with at St. Mike's, that I'm able to offer them the best care that the world has to offer. Truly, I can say that and mean it. And when I'm somewhere like in Abyei, you know, I can say to my patients, you know, I can do the best I can. And as a physician, sometimes, you know, that's not enough. Doing the best that I can meant that people would die for a lack of the right antibiotics or needing an x-ray or needing some time on a ventilator. So, as a doctor, I felt often that I was not being able to hold up my end of the bargain. People came to me seeking help, and I was only able to give it so far, and sometimes it wasn't far enough. And so that, you end up kind of inhabiting that space more often than you would like.
So the doctors that participate with Doctors Without Borders, they're all unpaid, is that correct?
You get a small stipend, you know, it's a tune of around, you know, $1,000 a month, or it was when I was away, enough to maybe cover some expenses at home, but that's, you know, a living stipend. All your expenses are taken care of in the country, so all your food and travel and stuff like that. And with more time and more experience, you can make, you know, slightly more, perhaps enough to live on and support a mortgage at home.
Now, most of your time in Sudan was spent in Abyei, right?
Correct.
Now, how does it work? You get there, you set up a camp, is that right?
Everything was, the mission was very new, so there was a structure set up. The hospital was existing before MSF arrived this time, and the huts, the tukuls where we lived, were made when I arrived. I was taking over I was the third doctor there, but it was still a very new mission, less than a year old. So some of the things, the infrastructure was still being developed. But the way it worked out is you would arrive, you'd do a needs assessment, and then based on what the needs were, you'd start to set up a more permanent setting like we needed, because Abyei, we assumed, was going to be a town that existed for a long time. And then from that, you start to work forwards.
And then do you go out into the community, or do you spend your time in that sort of hospital setting?
There's so much work to do in the hospital that I felt that was where my obligation was. You know, I felt that even at times I couldn't even leave with, I could spend all day and all night there. You know, there's people that needed attention. And so there was that kind of meta pressure that was weighing down on me all the time that I think I took a little bit too seriously. And I was able to go travel to mobile clinics, some quite distant away, you know, like an hour or so away on back roads and ox cart paths, and to get to see a little bit of the world outside of Abyei and a little bit of Sudan. And I didn't do enough of that, but I did get a chance to see the countryside on at least two occasions and understand better what type of world many of my patients were inhabiting.
So the hospital that you were a part of, that's staffed by MSF people?
Correct.
And do you have some people from locally that are there that are doctors perhaps that also assist?
Yeah, there was the other doctor was also an MSF doctor. He was Sudanese. He was from Khartoum. The nurses, about half were from Khartoum, half were from southern Sudan, and a handful were actually from Abyei. Now, the ones who were most trained were the nurses and doctors from Khartoum, because they have a long history of you know, universities and things like that. But some of our nurses were from the area, and we, MSF, makes an attempt as much as possible to try to employ as many people as we can in the country. And so, you know, up to 90% of the people that are working for MSF are national staff.
How did you find that the Sudanese were trained? Like, were they trained adequately?
It was variable. You know, it was quite variable. There was different attempts to perhaps make, you know, provide medical care in the country. There was all the way from a physician, and I would say that those people were adequately prepared to work in a hospital like the one that I was working in. The doctor that I worked with most was very competent, very new, and had a lot of, you know, experience. Or needed a lot of experience, but was also very competent. And then there was different levels of medical technicians who were trained for a year in very algorithmic, you know, practice of medicine. And their capacity was perhaps a little bit less. And on the nursing side, it was much more variable depending on where they went to school. So it's this, you know, as you can imagine, there wasn't quite the similar standards or body, governing body, that was able to enforce them in Sudan, is at least in my experience there.
You know, I haven't mentioned yet that you're there amidst a backdrop of a civil war,
right,
between factions. So who would you treat? I mean, anyone that came into the hospital you would treat?
Anyone. Yeah, I got to a point where, you know, I deliberately did not care which side they were. You know, I come to it in my book where there was a part of it when there was a small conflict that happened in Abyei. And I remember my field coordinator asking me, well, which side is it? And I said, I don't know. And I'd never asked that question. You know, we made a place that the only thing that we asked is that you leave your guns at the door. And aside from that, I didn't care if you're from the north or the south or, you know, African Muslim or Dinka or Misteria. It didn't really matter as long as you left your guns at the door. And that was part of what we were doing there, was to create that place where that was true, where people could feel safe from even a short respite from what was around them the whole time.
Now, how hot was it?
Yeah, for a Canadian, I think it's about as hot as it gets. The, you know, it was like up to 50 degrees Celsius or so.
Really?
Which I'd never experienced. It's so inhospitable and so pervasive and inescapable. So it was really, you know, I'm from northern Alberta, so it was, I liked the cold. I grew up liking it. You had to, I guess. And to be somewhere where it was so the opposite was one of the toughest things to get used to, you know.
There's an image in the book, and I forget what page it's on, but I made a note of it once I read it, that you were talking, I don't know where you were going, but you were saying that they couldn't land planes in some place because there were too many bricks and donkeys on the runway.
Right.
What was that? Like, they just descend there? I mean, what do you call that? They just
flop you down in the middle of a piece of flat land as close as you can get to, you know, where they can reliably get, you know, a takeoff and short takeoff and short landing. But anytime I think you start to use a piece of land, it gets rutted, people start to gather around there and cross it, and it becomes, you know, it's temporary. And then the rains, you know, if it rains, and then it becomes a bit unsafe. So it kind of shuffled, it got shuffled around a lot from place to place to place.
How did the blog start?
I mentioned I went away with MSF as a writer in 2005, and I wrote a blog from that. And so I knew that there was a certain power in the medium, you know, in the online medium. And I became MSF's first blogger, and I was looking forward to the chance not only to keep in touch with my family and friends, but to also kind of try to tell the story and maintain some type of connection. And I quickly realized that with the response that people were hungry to be in contact with this, you know, with other parts of the world, even these kind of hard parts, particularly even the hard ones that it's really tough to understand. And, you know, as the response to it grew, I realized that, you know, it was possible to connect. And so with that, you know, I learned some tools, you know, to mix media when you can, to pictures and video, and to provide some sense of immediacy and contact. And those people, through the internet connection and mine, and were connecting to Abye. And so at one point it got, you know, after I was probably midway through the mission, I was blogging, and it was getting quite popular. I think MSF realized something new. My blog had more traffic than their homepage did, because people just kept on linking to the blog or passing around links to the blog. And so I think that it took us, you know, all by surprise a little bit.
And did this help you cope, I guess, with being there?
Very much, yeah, it did. It not only did it help me cope, you know, in times when I felt really beaten down, you know, helpless, or like I said, not able to live up to my end of the doctor-patient relationship, where they came to me with their problems and I didn't have the solutions. Not only, you know, when that weighed me down the most, would I be able to get comments forwarded to me from MSF Canada, and it would make me feel like, okay, yeah, I'm doing okay. This is a good fight. You know, this is worthwhile. Even though it's difficult, it's worth it. Not only that, but it led to real world results. You know, at one point I was able to post a picture of a child who I was having a really tough time making a diagnosis on, and I got responses from many people from all over the world. And this kid who came into the hospital never having walked, you know, for 3 years of his life, and he's very thin and on the verge of, you know, starvation, never walked. We treated him for tuberculosis, and he stood up for the first time. And I'll never, obviously, forget it. I'll never, of all of the, you know, the hard experiences, the ones that were difficult to go through in my mind or in the book, kind of pale in comparison to that, you know, the nurse tugging me on the shoulder and pointing over and me seeing that for the first time. And it was such a measure of exactly what we were there to do.
Do you think we spend enough time where we are here in Canada, for example, myself, thinking about Sudan? And why do you think it should matter to us?
If anyone writes books with a question, that's mine. Like, why should we care about places so different? And, you know, I hearken back to when I was first starting to do this kind of work, and I was working with a mentor, a surgeon, who ended up being very important in my life and in my career. And I asked him, like, well, why am I doing this in the first place? You know, why do I go to these places, or why should I? And he said, because it's your bloody duty, that's why. And I thought, okay, that's good enough for me. You know, that's good enough for me. It's my duty. And if I see the problem and you recognize it and you have the tools, so that goes with some responsibility. If you don't have the tools or you don't recognize it, then perhaps the same isn't true. But for those of us, when we recognize that there's a part that we can play in diminishing the suffering of other people, even the people distant from us, then we should play it. Because that's what I think being truly human is. It's being able to care for other people, not just yourself.
So what should we do? Do you suggest that we spend 6 months there? I mean, what can we do?
I don't think everyone can. I mean, I think that the more hands that we can bring to the repair of the world, I think is, you know, the better. But if people aren't able to give, you know, 6 months of their life to Sudan, maybe give, you know, some thought to a place down the street that might need help, you know, that may be able to work in your own community to bring about some change that you want to see. And if, you know, even that is not possible, then give, you know, some thought to supporting MSF in their interest in pursuing this type of work. And if that isn't even possible, then just try to get the picture. Just understand the world that we live in. Because I think that with that, you know, at least understanding how people live in Sudan perhaps more properly places us where we are in our own lives here in Canada, and maybe even helps us act more correctly within our own personal spheres.
Would you go back to Sudan?
I'd love to. You know, it took me 6 months before. Up to that point, I was absolutely not. I'll go somewhere else, go to the Congo or somewhere, but not back to Sudan. Too hot, too many memories. But I think now is a time where I realize that perhaps, you know, my obligation is to be continued there, that perhaps I owe that. Now that I know what I know, maybe I should use that as much as possible to the betterment of that place, if I can.
Do you still smoke?
Of course not. It's bad for you.
But you had to take it up, didn't you, when you went over there, because it was sort of a currency, cigarettes were, right?
Yeah. I wish smoking was better for you. But unfortunately, it's not. Yeah, it's a tough one. It's, you know, probably if I wasn't a doctor, I don't know. It's a good question whether I would or not. But I think I got to give that up at some point.
You wrote a post on Mother's Day to your mom.
Right.
That's a pretty touching piece there. Did she read it? What did she think
of
it?
Oh yeah, of course. My mom is my biggest fan.
And she enjoyed it, I guess.
I think so. Yeah. You know, I think once you go to medical school, you have a get out of parental jail free card. And so I think that since then, my parents have been pretty proud of me, and they've, you know, I obviously miss them quite a lot because I don't live in the same province, but they're coming here for my book launch this week, so I get a chance to see them. I'm really happy about that.
And Sarah, what happened with her?
Yeah, you know, we've went our separate ways, and we're still friends, and she's alive and happy and well, like most of the people in my book.
And Dr. Meskalik writes about her in the book. They have some sort of relationship before he leaves, and I guess you just have to read the book to find out more. You needed sunglasses when you slept at night. Why was that?
Well, I guess my affection for sunglasses goes back a long way, you know. But I felt like any bit of protection that I could get from the Sudanese sun and from Sudan itself, that I would take it when I could get it. So,
and I'm trying to paint a picture here. What like when would the sun come up? And I guess you'd still be asleep, I suppose, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it was obviously a lot of the time I would sleep outside. It was so hot. I realized shortly after moving there that I looked around and saw the Sudanese people sleeping, and everyone was sleeping outside. And so quickly I did too. And that's the good thing about it is, or bad thing, I don't know. You get up at dawn with the roosters and everything else, so you gotta have your sunglasses nearby.
This might be a trite question, but what's the biggest change in your life you've noticed since coming back after 6 months there?
Well, you know, it's tough to notice if you've changed a lot. I think that I've, you know, had to change my life somewhat to write this book, and in some ways I'm just emerging for the first time since I came back from Sudan. I'm able to, you know, I've been so focused on that place and on this book and getting it out that I felt like I haven't been as present in my friends' lives or my family's life as I would want to be. So I look forward to that changing. For me personally, I think that its understanding of that place is still very much alive, and the people who I talk about in that book are still very real to me. And so in that way, my life has changed profoundly to compare to the 6 months before.
Was there any point after that you found it difficult to talk about all this?
Oh, very much. Yeah.
Do you think you've gotten over that?
It's still difficult to read parts of my book. I'm getting better at it. There's some passages in particular that are difficult. You know, there's one particular passage where I work with my colleagues to, you know, in vain to try to save a pregnant woman who's dying, and another where a blog post where I come back from the hospital to talk about a similar experience with a child who I was unable to save, and those are still, when I read them, have that same emotion kind of carried forward through it, or me carried back to that place. So yeah, it's still very present.
This is a powerful book, tremendously remarkable. Congratulations, Dr. Miskelic, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you. Thanks for talking with me.
You're very welcome. The book is called 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village, published by Doubleday. Its author, Dr. James Miskelic, on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.